Welcome to The Telegram. I'm Tim Stanley. Is the Pope a Catholic? Of course he is, but he said a lot of things since his election that have confused believers and non-believers alike. And we're going to get to the bottom of what Francis really thinks about homosexuality, atheism, and divorce. Also, are men hardwired to hate housework? We visit the domestic front of the battle of the sexes. I'm joined in the studio by the editor of Telegraph Blogs, Damien Thompson, Telegraph columnist Christina Adone, and Jake Wallace-Simons, a features writer for Telegraph Men. The election of Pope Francis 6 months ago brought surprise and excitement to the world's 1.2 billion Roman Catholics. A man from the New World taking over one of the oldest jobs in the Old World, and what a task he faced. The Catholic brand has been sullied by scandal, and trust in the Vatican is probably lower than at any time since the Reformation. Francis has impressed people by bringing honesty, openness, and humour to his role, giving an undoubted sense of rejuvenation. But there has also been some confusion, thanks to a number of statements on issues of sexuality and salvation that have left liberals cheering, conservatives scratching their heads, and the whole church on the edge of its seat, wondering what this charismatic man will say next. So is he a radical or just misunderstood? Damien Thompson, you've described Francis as the chatterbox pope. What do you mean by that?
He has an extraordinarily winning and spontaneous manner. He sometimes gives the impression of making things up as he goes along, which Catholic traditionalists find very unnerving. But I think the really important thing to say is that there has been the most extraordinary change of public perception. You could employ thousands of PR operatives, and they wouldn't achieve this, which is reversing the image of possibly the most unpopular organization in the world. The Pope doesn't just win people over with his smile. He says things like, who am I to judge gay people? Atheists can perhaps be saved. We need a new attitude towards divorced and remarried people in church. And this plays very well with the media, with some Catholics. But he's also, in all of those cases, poking a hornet's nest. He raises delicate and quite urgent questions without actually answering them.
Okay, let's deal with the issue of the effect he's had on the church then, as you began with that. Christina, do you agree?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, two things. One is, when was the last time you heard the Catholic Church being discussed in terms of clerical abuse rather than Pope Francis? Not for months. In fact, possibly 6 months. Second, Syria has placed him on the international world stage, and he feels comfortable, he looks comfortable, he sounds comfortable there. And although I think it is a dubious honor to be quoted by Vladimir Putin, he is so important that his words on peace have been the ones that Putin has tried to echo again and again. So he's a world player. He's a humble man of the people. He has brought home that message loud and clear with all those little touches. You know, he picks up his hotel bill and pays for it himself. He drives a little car rather than the Pope mobile. He is picking up the phone and talking to parishioners all over the world. He is wonderful. I mean, I have to say, I am like his biggest cheerleader.
Okay. So you both like him. We get that.
No, I love him.
You love him. Okay. Well, we all love him. I have to confess that I'm a Catholic too. But this question of popularity slightly disturbs me. The point of the church is not to be popular. It's not competing in a marketplace. It's not there trying to win out against other brands on the basis of being the most liked.
It is there to be heard. And if you are unpopular, you're not heard. Benedict was a very clever and a very holy man, but he was unpopular. He could not mask, he could not conceal the unpopularity of his church. And that meant that he was drowned out by lots of other voices. What is fantastic about Francis is that because he's popular, because he has that populist touch, he is listened to by Catholics and non-Catholics all around the world.
Yeah, but this is true. He's listened to, and I am a fan of his, but he's listened to on these super controversial subjects such as homosexuality and atheism and divorced and remarried people. And people take away a message from that is possibly at odds with the teaching of the church. And that kind
exactly.
of forces the judgment. The Pope says, who am I to judge? well, he's the Pope, but anyway, he's decided, who am I to judge, will be his line. And that kind of forces the judgment back to the parishes, back to the parish priests, back to the people in the pews, who are quite possibly faced with a conflict between a very clearly set out magisterium, very clearly set out catechism put together by John Paul II, and what amounts to little more than sort of nudges and winks and hints from the Pope that things might actually change, except that they won't actually change in these big areas.
I think that what you call nudges and winks are kicking open the doors, opening those windows and letting the air in, as Vatican II was supposed to do and never did. And I love the fact that he is something stirring. I think that is exactly what our church needs.
So, should it open the doors to women priests?
I'm not sure about women priests, but as a divorced Catholic, I can say it hurts very much to be excommunicated simply because I married a divorced man, a man who was left by his wife. So, you know, in curial terms, he should be allowed to...
This is all very well and good, but the Pope's job is not to change doctrine. The Pope's job is simply to articulate doctrine and defend it.
Well, I think he's articulating questions right now, and that is a very potent tool.
I'm not entirely sure he's articulating questions. I mean, we must be careful to be absolutely precise about what he has said about certain things. I mean, Damon, in some cases, I feel that people have jumped on his remarks. What he's really just offered is Christian charity, particularly on the subjects of what to do about gay and lesbian
people. Yeah, but he knew that people would jump on these remarks.
Of course,
right.
He did.
He knew that he wasn't actually saying anything that went against the magisterium, but he knew that people would jump on these remarks and take it a stage further, beyond the limits of official Catholic teaching. But there are problems here in the long term, because if you take the subject of women priests or validating gay sex, these are not subjects that the Catholic Church can play with, certainly not if they want to have any sort of relationship with the Orthodox or the Muslim world, or indeed developing world Catholics who are very conservative on these issues, as indeed are young Western Catholics increasingly. And also, the Catholic Church has taken definitive stances on these matters.
Well, hold on a second. Didn't we always have the Cardinal Hume line on, for instance, gay sex? And he said, you know, hate the sin, love the sinner. And that is basically what Pope Francis keeps saying. I love you. I am not one to judge. This is the sin.
I'm sorry, but
this
virtue. How can you hate the sin without judging? That's a judgment. Declaring something to be a sin is a judgment.
He is distancing. He's separating the sin from the sinner. He's saying...
No, I don't think he's doing so very convincingly. I think he's confusing people. Cardinal Hume, who always had a slightly Jesuitical side to him, used to say, yes, we hate the sin, but we love the sinner.
Yeah.
But this Pope is saying, well, who am I to judge? And that, I think, the takeaway for a lot of gay Catholics, shall we say, will be, perhaps it isn't a sin after all, or at least not a sin in the way that we used to think it was, and the Catechism says it is.
But it remains a sin because it is a sin in the Catechism. I mean, this is my point. The Pope cannot change these things. We are not the Anglican Church. One guy does not come along and just ask a few questions and suddenly the windows are open
exactly,
and everything's
changed.
Exactly,
people don't know that, Tim.
No, they don't, no. But that's why my personal interpretation is I think he is simply trying to articulate doctrine in a way that he thinks people will be able to engage with, but I fear that the laity don't understand what he's doing.
Well, that's because he hasn't articulated the doctrine. I do like him. I am delighted by many of the things he does. He's obviously a wonderful person. But there are problems further down the line when detailed questions are asked. So, Holy Father, is it okay for divorced and remarried people to receive communion? Is it okay for somebody who is openly gay but celibate to put themselves forward for seminary training? Now, at the moment, the Church says it's not. That admittedly is not a question of doctrine, but it's something
precisely
that was hammered home pretty clearly by the previous two popes.
I think that where the two of you are acting like, you know, little Catholic catechismal students is you are getting doctrine and all the wrapping around doctrine mixed up. When he talks about Catholics and gays, he is leaving the door open for precisely the instance that Damien has just articulated, which is young man, used to be gay, feels the vocation, wants to become a priest. Who is there to say no to him?
Well,
certainly not Pope Francis.
A dicastery of the church has already said no to him. I personally thought that was a mistake.
A complete mistake.
In bigger issues that are being raised, we're talking about an apparent conflict between the church's teaching and a stance that the Pope is encouraging rather than stating. Let me get this clear. I'm not speaking here from the point of view of a Catholic catechist. My training's in the sociology of religion, and if you like, I'm looking at it as somebody who studied the sociology of religion, saying here is a potential institutional crisis in the making, which is a leader is sending out messages but not spelling them out, which conflict with the body of church teaching, and this is going to sow enormous confusion.
Okay, as a sociologist of religion, here's the question. Is the future for the Catholic Church, for the 1.2 billion Catholics, better off with a pope like Francis? Or would it have been better off if Francis had not been made pope?
It's very difficult to say.
I think it's easy,
How would you measure success?
I measure success by the fact that when I look around the television screens, when I read my newspapers, when I listen to the radio, I am no longer embarrassed of being a Catholic.
Well, I hope you weren't embarrassed when Pope Benedict
was born. Why were you embarrassed before?
Well, I was embarrassed when nobody was doing anything about those abusive priests. I was embarrassed. What I love
Well, apart from Benedict, that is.
No, I didn't say
Benedict.
I'm talking about what Pope Francis has done, is he's done so much that is positive for the Catholic Church that its mistakes, and there are plenty, are now in the back.
And I'm delighted by that. And that was the very first thing that I said.
Yes,
but
no, I agree.
He's at the beginning, we hope, he's at the beginning of his pontificate. And there are very, very complex and delicate issues to be thrashed out. And also, what worries me is that he's raising expectations that cannot be fulfilled and that actually he doesn't really wish to fulfill, because I don't actually think he is a card-carrying liberal. But I do think that some of his gestures are being hijacked by people who are.
I think also some people who represent or are victims of abuse might see some of what he's done as rather superficial, as being something which distracts from rather than deals directly with the problem of clerical abuse.
I think that any victim of abuse would think anything that happened afterwards is superficial because they want their whole innocence restored, and that's impossible. But I think that where the two of you are being a bit slow is... it's happened already. I mean, what is brilliant about this is that we have the Pope being talked about as a major player in the Syrian conflict, something impossible to have imagined only a few months ago.
Well,
but it happened during the Cold War. It happened with Pope John Paul.
Yes, but I mean,
it happened during the first Gulf War as well.
Yes.
And forgive me if I'm just a little bit cynical about Pope's interventions on the international scene. I don't think they often make much difference, but...
Well, and also they're always promote peace, which is the right thing to do, but nonetheless, it's never a very surprising line. I think, Christina, where I disagree with you is for me personally, there is no point in having a popular Catholic Church if it is not still definitively and clearly and orthodoxly Catholic. I don't want to see the Church change just for the sake of having a few more bums on seats.
I don't think, as Damien has said, you know, his statements, I would agree, have been quite... if not opaque, let's say malleable. You can just see
Jesuitical would be a good word.
Casuistry is obviously his second name. But I have to say, I think it is important that he is popular. I think it is important that our church is popular. And I just hope he goes on and on and on, even with one lung.
One thing I have heard suggested, Damien, is that the church might become a little bit more like the Anglicans, in which people have a sort of interior spiritual life where they decide things for themselves. And the church itself, you know, presents a place to meet, you know, still provides the mass and all those key things, but people are essentially left alone to decide for themselves what they believe. Do you think that's a future?
It's a danger. I mean, what's really happening to Anglicanism is that it's falling apart and people are no longer bothering to attend its services. That's because if you really don't agree with what your church teaches or you're not sure what it teaches, then the chances are that you probably don't have a strong enough religious faith to drag you out of bed on Sunday mornings. And I think that, by and large, the appeal to young people and liberal Catholics is a bit naive in that their response will simply be occasionally to go along to something and perhaps to smile warmly when the Pope says something charming, but they won't actually subscribe to the teachings of the Church or go to church. Meanwhile, you'll have the phenomenon, which you do have within Anglicanism, of a group of relatively hard-line Orthodox believers, the only people who can be bothered to go to church, who will actually push the church in the opposite direction from that which Francis seems to be pushing it. In other words, they'll be sticking very, very firmly to the magisterium. And I see this all the time when I deal with young Catholics. 20, 30 years ago, young Catholics were the ones calling for a revision of teaching on contraception, calling for women priests. Not now.
Now they're often the most conservative.
The most conservative.
Yes.
An appallingly sort of stuffy and hypocritical way.
Okay. Well, I don't take that as a personal insult, but Christina, I really don't. Christina,
you're not that young.
No, it's just piling it on. Christina, finally, and I want to close on that point. I think it's a very important one. I sometimes wonder if some of the people excited by Francis sort of miss where the church really is trending among young people, and particularly where it's trending in the developing world, that if the growth areas are actually among conservatives or the Orthodox rather than liberals.
I don't buy that. Otherwise, the evangelical churches would not be having such a fantastic, making such fantastic inroads. I think that where he is best is in his humanity. I think that he is very, very conservative in terms of his ideology, I think in terms of his theology, but I think that what is brilliant about him is that he soars above this conservative stroke liberal label. He is really, really impressive, and I think that people feel that there's a genuine, you know, he's not a party man, he's not a kind of label man, he's not a brand. He is himself, and that genuine self is really, really touching.
Christina Rodoni and Damian Thompson, thank you both very much. In 21st century Britain, women are liberated and men are cool with that, except maybe in one crucial area, housework. Our features writer Jake Wallace-Simons has written a controversial piece that will probably confirm what a lot of couples already know, that men are far happier living with their own filth than women are. So is the imbalance in household tasks something that is perfectly natural, something that we all have to get on and deal with? Or when a man says, "I'm not really bothered about the state of the loo," does he really mean, "I'm waiting for you to clean it, dear"? Jake, can you explain your thesis for us?
Well, I think my thesis, I mean, it's quite self-evident, isn't it, that in most married homes and people who are cohabiting, it tends to be the woman who does the vast majority of the housework. That's just how things happen. Often you might meet on equal terms, perhaps when you're at university and you're young and idealistic, and you would never have dreamed that in 5 years' time, you know, even if you're both working full-time, inevitably the woman will be doing the vast majority of the housework, and that's just something which is self-evident, I think. My view is that I don't know if natural is quite the right word. I mean, most people do fall into those stereotypes, whether it's because of biology or because of culture or whatever it is. And I think that from a man's point of view, we tend not to really be too worried about living with a bit of mess. And unless something has to be cleaned because it's in the way, there's no reason to clean it. But I think for a woman, they're far more sensitive about it. And I think that's where the imbalance stems from.
Yeah. Well, I live alone and my house is like a waste ground. I mean, it's disgusting. Tell us about the cushions.
Oh, the cushions. I mean, that was a case in point to illustrate the difference in mentality between men and women. My wife some years ago bought what I understand is called an accent cushion.
Right.
An accent cushion, if you don't know what it is like any other cushion, only it serves no purpose.
Right. No one ever sits on this thing. No one cuddles this thing.
The only time somebody takes hold of this accent cushion is to remove it from the bed to get into the bed.
Right.
Or to replace it on the bed once you've got up.
Right.
So its main function is to adorn the bed. And
right.
We have an ongoing argument about it because I think it's utterly pointless because not only does it have no practical purpose, but nobody goes into our bedroom during the day.
Yeah.
No one sees it apart from myself and my wife. My kids come in the morning and sort of see it. But, you know, I just can't see the point of it. And yet we have this ritual of removing it at the night,
right,
and then putting it back in the morning.
Well, no one goes into my bedroom full stop, which is why I just leave it in the state it's in when I get up. Christina, do you identify with this? Do you see where Jake's coming from?
I certainly identify with the accent cushions. I love them. And not only do I have them on our bed, I make the boys have it on their beds and the girl have it on hers. So I'm really into accent cushions. However, I do agree with Jake that in our household, I'm the one who does most of the household chores. And that is simply quality control. The husband, the stepsons, 18 and 20, may I point out, are hopeless with a broom, a cloth, a Hoover.
Yeah.
So it's not that we didn't start out equal. We started out equal. I said, you know, I hate boring drudgery. I hate household work. But then I saw, you know, I was good at it. He is hopeless. And so are the boys. So I'm afraid... I do agree with you. You know, it's a real turf war between the sexes.
But why in gender terms, should men... that sounds like as a test group, rather conclusive proof that men literally genetically can't clean. And do you think there's something to that?
I think you just don't have very perfectionist strains. I think
right.
We women are much more perfectionist than you are. I think you think broad picture,
right?
Broad brush.
There's no dead dog in my front room.
Exactly. If
there I'm doing well.
No. But I mean, I promise you. You know, I've seen it with the boys. Okay, so there is a mug. In that mug, there's cigarette ash. There is vodka. There is Coca-Cola, and then they've splashed on some biscuity stuff, which is now growing mold. Now, until that mug stinks,
right.
They won't touch it.
Right. Jake?
I mean, I should say that actually I didn't quite get to my thesis. That was my observation, but thesis...
Okay.
The cushions were so good.
The cushions. That was observational stuff. But my thesis is, I think, that men just have to try a bit harder. I mean, I try until it hurts.
Oh, you're wimping out.
No, I think it's absolutely right, because I just don't think that they're... You know, even though it's true that men, perhaps naturally, in general, aren't as good at it as women are, I think that there's no reason why a professional woman should be doing, I think on average, 7 hours a week of housework. And a professional man should not be doing anything at all. I think only 13% of husbands do more housework than their wives in Britain. And so I do try really hard and I fall short. But I try, and I think that's right that I do that. One example of what you were saying, Christina, was happened recently is that I was working from home and thought, right, what I'll do is I'll clean something. And I couldn't see anything worth cleaning particularly, so I tried to put myself in my wife's head and think, if I was her, what would I see that would require cleaning? And I thought, well, maybe the bath would need cleaning, the bath and the loo. So I did all that in my lunch break. And came back downstairs, and when she came back, I was expecting her to be very impressed. And in fact, she was appalled, because I had overlooked the fact that the washing needed to be done and the dishwasher needed to be put on, and I'd gone for the grand gesture and ignored the everyday practicalities.
Right.
But
it's the broad brush approach to life. You just don't get it. You know, it's the little corners. It's those little details. You know, the under the loo seats that you have to check. So I actually think men should only do the big stuff, like you should remove the rubbish. You should do, you know, the separating of the recycling stuff. My husband loves that. You can do the gardening. You know, you can do the big stuff, but just leave the rest to us, because we do it so much better. We expect of one, you know, we expect of each other such different things. You know, I expect of you to be able to clean everything and leave everything perfectly tidy. and you expect of me to do it.
But so, what about rather than men raising their game to match women's standards, what about women lowering theirs to match ours? I mean, as the wonderful Quentin Crisp said, you know, don't try and keep up with the Joneses, drag them down to your level.
I can't stand the smell, quite
right,
frankly.
Right.
No, and also I can't stand the untidiness. I don't think or write or relax in an untidy mess.
But I agree. I mean, I think there's room for compromise the other way too. And as I often tell my wife, that, you know, relax, don't worry, I can take the bin out tomorrow morning rather than tonight. I mean, this is a conversation that we often have. And I think that there is room for a bit of flexibility there. But I think that men are, you know, needs to compromise more. I think the balance needs to move more towards the woman's side than it does towards us.
I think that the best thing is for the man to put aside every week a little allowance, and with that you pay somebody else, a third party, whether it's a man or a woman, that third party comes in and does the chores. And
exactly.
Then everybody's happy.
And that's the natural compromise. I want to close with a wonderful, very, very English black joke that a friend of mine, his mother was rather ill, and she said to my friend's father, "What will you do if I pass away?" And my friend's father put his arm around her and said, "Please, don't worry about it. I'll get a cleaner." Jake Wallace Simons and Christine Rodone, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
For more opinion and commentary, you can find us at telegraph.co.uk.